Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're counting down to open enrollment for the online insurance marketplace for people who want to sign up for insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act. It's fair to say that after several years of relatively stable open enrollment experiences, we're kicking off things this time around with a lot of confusion.
Well, a whole lot of confusion, Mark. So let's start with a few important specifics. President Trump has reduced the amount of time allotted for the open enrollment period from 3 months, which it's been really since the beginning, down to 6 weeks. And he's also practically eliminated the budget for marketing the health insurance marketplaces around the country. Here in our home state of Connecticut, where there's pretty robust support for the Affordable Care Act, consumers are getting a lot of messaging about open enrollment, not so much in many states where there's been very little support.
And the president has also been sending confusion into the insurance industry, as well as making things difficult for state insurance commissioners. The president has been switching his stance on a number of issues, saying he was canceling the cost-sharing reduction payments to insurers to help lower out-of-pocket costs for consumers. But he also said he might support a bipartisan bill in the Senate to stabilize the markets for 2 years. Then he switched his tune a day later, saying that he couldn't support it. Now no one's sure what he's going to do next.
And I understand that now Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he might actually be in favor of supporting short-term stabilization if the president gives some clear signal about what kind of bill he might sign. Meanwhile, of course, we come back to our first point. Consumers are understandably confused as well.
But there's one thing they should be really confident in, that open enrollment runs from November 1st to December 15th. That's just 6 weeks, so we encourage everyone to enroll. And here in Connecticut and in those states with their own insurance marketplaces, they need to check in with their state insurance sites. But for consumers in most other states, just go to healthcare.gov website and you should find the information you need.
The healthcare.gov site has a pretty easy to follow checklist that can help guide you as you prepare to enroll you and your family. Health analysts do predict that fewer people will sign up for coverage this year, partly because they just aren't getting the message, and that would be unfortunate after we've had so much progress on insuring and raising the rate of people in this country who have health insurance.
All it takes is one serious diagnosis, such as cancer, for instance, to cost uninsured patients hundreds of thousands of dollars. Without insurance, that could lead to financial devastation as well as physical challenges. So remember to make sure that you get coverage for you and your family during this open enrollment period.
Well, Mark, speaking of cancer, we're seeing some exciting new developments with targeted therapies, and that's something that our guest today knows well. Dr. Michael Caligiuri is president of the American Association for Cancer Research, and they recently released their annual report, and there are some exciting new trends in cancer research and treatments that look very promising.
Laurie Robertson also stops by. The managing editor of factcheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Michael Caligiuri in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Whiplash. That's how one healthcare pundit from Kaiser Health News describes the current scenario around health policy in Washington. After months of intermittent reprieves, the president abruptly announced recently that he was cutting off cost-sharing reduction subsidies to insurers, subsidies that help lower costs for low- and middle-income Americans buying insurance on the marketplaces. That announcement led to an immediate backlash from the insurance industry, as well as advocates for healthcare consumers, saying that such a move will force insurers to charge higher premiums next year, forcing those most vulnerable consumers to pay more. Then came a last-minute bipartisan deal to stabilize the markets. Democratic Senator Patty Murray and Republican Lamar Alexander offering this compromise bill in an effort to keep the market stable for the short term. The president said first he was for it, the next day he was against it. And now Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, one of the most ardent opponents of the Affordable Care Act, said he might support the bipartisan measure or at least bring it to the floor for a vote, but only if the president gives a clear signal about what kind of bill he might sign. Since Republicans and President Trump now own the narrative of the health care law, they'll have to answer to the fallout from any destabilization of the insurance market on their watch. McConnell saying he's not really sure, based on the president's actions thus far, what kind of bill he will sign. One thing is certain, if there's no action to preserve the CSR payments into the next year, consumers will pay more. Meanwhile, House Speaker Paul Ryan has said he will not support the bipartisan measure, so chances of it passing look a little sketchy at the moment. Still, it does seem the bipartisan bill is getting bipartisan steam. At least 60 senators have indicated they would support it. Some of the nation's governors are letting the president know what they think of his efforts to sabotage Obamacare, including some key Republicans. Nevada's Republican Governor Brian Sandoval, speaking to the Nevada Independent, outlined who will be harmed by the president's actions. He says it's going to hurt people, kids, families, individuals. He says it'll hurt people with mental health issues and veterans. It's going to hurt everybody, he said. Sandoval is president of the National Governors Association. As Puerto Rico continues to reel from the after effects of Hurricane Maria, there are looming new health threats as much of the island remains without electricity or running water. More people are resorting to bathing in and drinking from contaminated wells and water sources. The numbers of illnesses and deaths related to tainted water are on the rise. A reversal for Johnson & Johnson. A California woman had been awarded more than $400 million in a lawsuit claiming her use of Johnson & Johnson's baby powder caused ovarian cancer. But a judge tossed out the award, setting the stage for a new legal action. The woman claimed her use of baby powder for feminine hygiene led to the illness. Her lawyer is filing an immediate appeal. Meanwhile, there are some 5,000 similar cases against Johnson & Johnson claiming the talc in the baby powder has led to their cancers as well. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Michael A. Caligiuri, president of the American Association for Cancer Research, which represents 37,000 cancer researchers in over 100 countries. Dr. Caligiuri is a professor of molecular virology, immunology, and medical genetics at Ohio State University School of Medicine, and is director of the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center and CEO of the Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital and the Richard J. Solove Research Institute. He's president of the Society of Natural Immunity and chair of the Institute of Medicine's National Cancer Policy Forum. Dr. Caligiuri earned his bachelor's degree from SUNY Buffalo and his master's in medical degree from Stanford University. He completed his medical residency in internal medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Dr. Caligiuri, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Yeah. What a nice introduction.
We're sort of at that pivotal juncture in history in terms of potential breakthroughs in cancer research and discovery. Cancer still remains a complex and challenging foe. And your organization just released its annual report on the state of cancer research. And some causes for optimism: cancer death rates are down in this country, about 35% in children and down 25% in adults since 1991. And that seems to be a good direction. And yet 660,000 Americans are still expected to die from cancer-related causes in 2017. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners, give us an overview of where we are on the war on cancer.
Well, I would say great progress, but a lot more to do. We're learning a lot about how cells divide, what causes cancer. And I think the biggest thing we've learned is that for any one cancer, let's say colon cancer, there are actually a multitude of causes, and that is where the complexity comes in. So no one single treatment is going to work in every particular colon cancer. That's a big, big kind of a breakthrough moment in the last, say, 10 to 15 years. We all know people today living successfully with cancer or cured of cancer, whereas, you know, 30 years ago, I think it's safe to say that none of us could really think of someone living successfully or cured of cancer easily. So in many instances, what we're doing is we're turning cancer into a chronic disease. There's a number of cancers, including lung cancer, actually, leukemias, lymphomas, where they're now treated with a pill, and it becomes a chronic disease for years, where a death sentence was imminent within months. So So we still have challenges. We still have to figure out the multitude of causes. But what's promising is it seems that as we figure out the cause of a particular subset of cancer patients, we can come up with a medicine that can target it with a lot less toxicity than traditional chemotherapy.
Well, Dr. Caligiuri, you know, we were thinking and preparing for today that it's been close to 50 years since President Nixon declared his war on cancer. And last year, of course, Vice President Joe Biden creating the Moonshot for Cancer after losing his son to brain cancer. This new effort, which you're contributing to, is predicated on the fact that cancer is not based on just one cause or syndrome or pathogen or cell marker. And certainly we've all stood in awe, really, of the results of the mapping of the human genome in 2004. So tell us more about this half century of cancer research, both in terms of the breakthroughs on causes and the potential cures you referenced.
Well, it's almost without exception that for every type of cancer, we've had some phenomenally important breakthroughs that have helped us improve that rate of death from cancer. Take, for instance, colon cancer. About 20 years ago, we discovered the gene that causes colon cancer in about 5% of people. We've since developed a test where we can find that in a colon cancer. In this particular type, it's passed on to the family with 50% rate. So right. If you had colon cancer and you have this particular gene, 50% of your brothers and sisters would all have this gene. But we can now detect that on a simple glass slide. And then with a simple blood test or even a little scrape from the buccal swab of the mouth, we can determine who's carrying the gene. And while they have a 80 to 90% chance of getting colon cancer, once we see you carry that gene, we start routine colonoscopies at the age of about 25. And you're never going to get that colon cancer. So there's an example where we've had a breakthrough discovery and actually had very meaningful impact. We actually did a study for 3 years, collected 3,000 colon cancers, identified hundreds of people that carry the gene, and they'll never get colon cancer. Mm-hmm. That study cost us $4 million to do, but it saved the state of Ohio $40 million, mm-hmm. and 745 years of life were saved. So basic research is important. And if we invest the $4 million, we save $40 million and hundreds of years of lives.
Well, basic discovery and research does cost money. And I think the United States has something to be proud of that we've had a government effort to fund medical and scientific research for decades. I think recently there's been concern amongst many that that ranking is slipping away. And we're still waiting to see what happens in the 21st Century Cures Act, which earmarked a significant amount of money for cancer research. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the impact in U.S. funding as we compare to others around the world to still make sure that this is a bipartisan effort that continues to be a country that leads in this effort.
So we have been the leader, and you're right, it is slipping because for the last 15 years, the NIH has been flat funded by Congress. So with inflation, we're getting about 75 cents or 80 cents on every dollar that's invested. And with that, a number of young investigators who would have been funded have left the field. And that's where we all suffer as a society, because it's really the young minds that need to come along, and they're the ones with the energy that make those great discoveries. And without them, you know, there'll be a generational loss in those discoveries, and the consequences are not good for the field in cancer and any other diseases. The good news is that through organizations like the American Association for Cancer Research and about 300 or 400 others, the Rally for Medical Research, we're rallying for the last 5 years, our legislators, and there is bipartisan support. So I'm happy to say that a bit ago, we got a $2 billion increase in the $30 billion or so that the NIH spends on research. We're hoping for that for fiscal year 18. What we'd really like to see is just a 3 to 4% increase every year. We need to fund about 20 to 22% of our investigators who are trying to get funded. And I think it was Mary Lasker who once said, if you think research is expensive, try disease.
Right.
You know, we're spending about $30 billion a year on research, but these diseases are costing us well over $500 billion a year. So it pays to invest in research.
Well, Dr. Caligiuri, I want to drill down a little bit on some of these promising therapies that are starting to emerge out of decades of truly collaborative research. You yourself are a specialist in immunotherapies and their power to trigger the body's own cancer-fighting response. We had Director Dr. Francis Collins on the show, who oversaw the Human Genome Project and also headed up the Precision Medicine Initiative. And we have entirely new bodies of research underway based on genomic discoveries. So more interdisciplinary collaboration going on than ever. Talk to us about some of these emerging trends.
It's a much more collaborative world now. Once we understood that there are so many different types of cancer, it became apparent to us that I'm not going to have enough patients to study at my own institution. I'm actually going to need hundreds of thousands of patients to find the 50 or 60 that have not only colon cancer, but colon cancer by this particular cause, or lung cancer by this particular cause, or pancreas. So that led to another realization that we have to share to create progress. You order a book on Amazon of mice and men, and what happens in 2 minutes? You get, well, if you like the mice and men, you'd like these three books. They have a database of millions of people. They found a couple thousand that ordered mice and men, and they served them up to you, and they're correct. So we're building the Amazon for cancer now. One is Project Genie. The AACR has coalesced the genomes from all over the world, putting them into a single language and entering them into a public database. It's not just sitting in a basement in a university somewhere, but actually being loaded into a public database where researchers have access to that data. The other is, I think, immunotherapy. You mentioned it. One of the things we've learned, the way the cancer works is often the way an army will work, right? It wants to get through enemy lines. And so what cancer does is it actually secretes molecules that put the immune system to sleep. Then it can just walk right through the enemy lines. And recently, we've learned there are molecules that are called checkpoints. We've developed checkpoint inhibitors, so they block the checkpoints. And it discovers the enemy right within their midst and can attack it and kill it. We're not targeting the tumor, actually. We're simply waking up the immune system. It's in its infancy. There'll be several decades of research on how the immune system can destroy cancer, but clearly there are palpable results at this point. I call it the fifth dimension of cancer therapy. There was first surgery, then radiation, then chemo, then targeted drugs, and now immune therapy. Very, very exciting progress.
We're speaking today with Dr. Michael A. Caligiuri, president of the American Association for Cancer Research. Dr. Caligiuri is a professor of molecular virology, immunology, and medical genetics at Ohio State University School of Medicine and CEO of the Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital. Dr. Caligiuri, I wanted to pull the thread on your quote, Mary Lasker, who was a great health activist. If you think research is expensive, try disease. The cost and burden for treatment is incredibly high. It costs some $90 billion in 2014 alone. Are there any cost-controlling techniques out there or anything that you all are promoting?
There's several issues. One is we need more funding for prevention research. Personally, I believe the cure to cancer is prevention, where ultimately we will have the tools to know who is going to get cancer and then develop the behavioral and pharmacologic things that we need to do to prevent that cancer. For example, wouldn't it be great if we knew from the time of birth who was going to be addicted to smoking? There's an answer to that, you know, the behavioral interventions to prevent that. So that's ultimately where we'll go. And just take, you know, smoking, for example, is a huge, huge cause of cancer. Lung cancer by far surpasses all other cancers. So more research on smoking cessation, more activity at the policy level on how can we further curb, you know, the tobacco industry. That's critical. If we want to lower the cost, we've got to get at the root of the problem. You know, it's very, very expensive to develop the drugs, techniques in surgery and radiotherapy, immune therapy. The real cost, as you say, is the burden of the disease. But the time, the productivity that's lost from the diagnosis of cancer, the cost of that is equal or greater to actually the cost of the treatment. So AACR is putting great efforts into prevention, behavioral research, health disparities, all of the things that can lead to a lower incidence of cancer. And, you know, if you don't have cancer, it's not going to cost us much.
Well, Dr. Caligiuri, kind of reading my mind there on this issue of prevention through regular screening under evidence-based guidelines and thinking about the opportunities that we have in primary care. I think of colon cancer or cervical cancer and the ability for HPV vaccine. And, you know, each one of those, I can tell you as primary care providers, it is a very heavy lift to get those rates of screening up and to get people to engage with this. Now, what's the conversation about the role of primary care, especially in the health disparities issue?
Health disparities, so just to define that, is different outcomes for different groups of people based on race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status. Huge problem. If you look at some of the diseases like prostate cancer and breast cancer, we have a higher death rate in, for example, the African-American population, twice as high for prostate cancer, and about 40% higher in breast cancer for African-American men and women, respectively. And it's multi-pronged, you know, it's access to care. There's all sorts of barriers that exist for those who are less fortunate. So to your point, Margaret, we can have all the guidelines in the world, but if we can't implement an effective strategy to incentivize people to adhere to these, what I call behavioral modifications to lower the risk of getting cancer, for example, raising the price of cigarettes, it's clearly been shown to help keep people from smoking. You know, we've got to develop policies, effective policies, that allow us to raise the price of cigarettes to incentivize those people to participate in the effective screening that already exists. And personally, I feel that fiscal incentives should be a big part of it. Again, with the principle that this may cost us a little money to get people to the primary care physicians, but think of what we're saving.
No, you're absolutely right. And I know our own Weizmann Institute has worked with Yale University on a randomized trial looking at financial incentives for folks who were in the Medicaid population for tobacco cessation. And, you know, I want to pivot and talk about a word that seems to be growing more prevalent, and that's collaboration. And you formed your own partnership collaboration called Orion. And the American Association of Cancer Researchers also have a similar effort, the Genie Project. I wonder if just share with our listeners sort of this much broader approach to trying to get at this vaccine problem.
With regard to Genie, as I mentioned, it's the realization that, hey, we're all collecting these genomes in different languages. So the AACR, you know, put the money into collecting these genomes, putting them through a filter into a common language, and then making it accessible to the research world. ORION stands for the Oncology Research Information Exchange Network. So, again, a network of cancer centers and community hospitals that have agreed to share their patient data in a HIPAA-compliant fashion so that we could find those smaller cohorts of patients who are identical not only at the disease type, but actually at the molecular and the stage and the race, like patients like me. Mm-hmm. And we started this about 3 years ago, and within 2.5 years, we've got 17 cancer centers across this country. We have 200,000 patients who are consented, and they consent to three things. You can follow me for my lifetime, you can do what you need to do with my tissue, and you can contact me if you have something for me. And we realized this is what patients want. They want their data shared. And they want it shared in a meaningful way that brings them results in a faster, better way. I'll be announcing a collaboration between Orion and Project Genie, underrepresented minorities, and making sure that both operations are doing their best to collect tumor samples from minorities who are literally underrepresented in these various efforts.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Michael Caligiuri, president of the American Association for Cancer Research, which represents 35,000 cancer researchers in over 100 countries. You can learn more about their work by going to the AACR.org, and you can follow his work on Twitter at Ohio State Med, hashtag Michael Caligiuri. Dr. Caligiuri, thank you for the work you are doing, and thank you for joining us on Conversation on Healthcare today.
Well, it's been my great pleasure. Thanks for all that you do.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump has claimed that under the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies have, quote, taken advantage of this country and, quote, made a fortune. He said he stopped that by ending payments for cost-sharing subsidies on the ACA marketplaces. That's misleading at best for several reasons. Health insurance companies have made money, an increase in net income of 46% from 2015 to 2016, according to a report from the company AM Best. But that was in spite of, not because of, the ACA marketplaces. An AM Best associate director told CNN Money that insurers lost millions and millions on Obamacare. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners sent us data showing that insurers reported an underwriting loss of $4.7 billion in 2016 on the individual market, which would include plans sold on and off the ACA marketplaces. Trump pointed to the increased stock prices of four companies, but two of them, Humana and Aetna, pulled out of the ACA marketplaces for 2018, and a third company, Anthem, pulled out of some states and counties. Also, the ACA limits the amount of profit insurers can make. At least 80% of premiums must go toward covering health costs. The rest can go toward administrative costs, profits, marketing, and salaries. If insurers don't meet those requirements, they have to issue rebates to consumers. Insurers should actually do well because of Obamacare. Millions of people have gained insurance, and some companies have succeeded where others have withdrawn. But insurers say they've had to increase premiums, as Trump has reminded voters, in order to cover the cost of a sicker pool of consumers than expected. On October 12th, the Trump administration announced it was immediately cutting off payments to insurers for the cost-sharing subsidies. These are separate from the premium tax credits that lower the cost of premiums for those who qualify. Under the ACA, insurance companies are required to sell policies with lower out-of-pocket costs to those earning between 100% and 250% of the federal poverty level and buying plans on the ACA marketplaces. The government then sends the cost-sharing subsidy payments to the insurers, reimbursing them for the cost of the discounted coverage. Many insurers submitted higher premium increases for 2018 because they were uncertain whether the Trump administration would continue the subsidies. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. For all the people in the world without limbs, acquiring prosthetics can be costly and out of reach. It's especially challenging to make prosthetics for children, since they are in constant state of growth. Rochester Institute of Technology scientist Dr. John Shule stumbled upon a clever and affordable solution, provided online open source templates to anyone anywhere in the world who has access to a 3D printer, and provide prosthetic hands for next to nothing.
I've made this Google Maps mashup. If you have a 3D printer and you'd like to help, put yourself on this map. And if you know someone who needs a hand, put yourself on this map.
So he founded the Enable Network, which has massed thousands of volunteer makers, providing cheap but functional prosthetics for children in need.
We know that we've delivered about 800 hands devices, and we suspect that a comparable number have been downloaded by people we can't track because we put all of our design on the internet.
The movement has grown so rapidly, the simple limb designs have become more sophisticated as recipients of the prosthetic devices provide feedback for designers to make more efficient devices.
We're still working on individual finger movements. These things grip or ungrip. That's all they do. So they're much less functional than a biological hand, and they're also less functional than a fancy myoelectric hand. But for kids, it's huge because those expensive devices are typically out of reach for children who would outgrow them. And, you know, our hands don't even pretend to look like regular hands. They look like superhero Iron Man hands, and for that very reason, they're very popular with kids.
Enable, a global collaborative network of open source designs, linking makers with 3D printers to provide low-cost prosthetic limbs to children and adults around the world. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.